I'm not sure if we'll get anyone else. Mondays are a tougher day. And just for fun, we have a time change or time zone change. So we're now in Eastern Standard Time here, anyways. I forget where you are, Mark. Where are you? You're in California, aren't you? Pardon?
Pacific State.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, near Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. So it's only 9 where you are. You still changed time as well, didn't you?
Yes, and I've been in Ireland for hours.
In Ireland for hours, okay.
Yeah, they started at 2 a.m. my time. I didn't join them at 2 a.m. my time. But yeah. I did get in before 6 a.m. Yikes.
I've had that experience. I was participating in a Fair's Fair book sprint over a couple of weeks, and it was all on European time. So I just became European time for 2 weeks. It was actually kind of an interesting experience. I was up super early every morning and going to sleep well before sunset.
Yeah, so you have a hard time going to sleep that early. So.
Yeah. Well, when you convert over completely, it's no longer early.
Yeah, at least it'll be dark. So I've been doing this, you know, off and on for the last 2 years. A lot of stuff's in Europe, right? A lot of conferences.
Yeah.
But now it's going to get dark. 5 p.m. local time or 5:15 local time. So maybe I'll be able to go to sleep at 7 o'clock, but I doubt it.
Speaking of conferences in Europe, there's one on AI and education from UNESCO. I'm trying to find the link for it, but I don't know if I have it on this computer.
Yeah, I signed up for that.
Yeah, okay, good. That's December 7 and 8, as I recall. I'll put the link actually in the newsletter because I think it's worth signing up for, even though, again, the hours are ridiculous. But it's a fairly high-level conference. It's actually interestingly organized by the People's Republic of China, even though the time zone is Europe. So, but of course, there'll be speakers from all over. But I find that interesting. I think it's good that there is participation from China in the whole topic of AI ethics and learning analytics ethics. There was a diagram, I wish I could remember where it was. That was the title was something like Landmarks of Ethics in AI from China. And it pointed to a number of really key documents. And it's similar to the sort of document that I sent out in last week's newsletter, the Fjeld Report, with, again, the list of important papers. But they're all different papers. So I want to find that. Because, of course, it belongs as part of our inquiry.
Yeah, I think looking to UNESCO, now that they have this major initiative, you know, I keep one eye on them, kind of. But I think now it'll be more active engagement.
Yeah.
Because here in the U.S., I can't get any traction with further education, as the Scots call it. Here, adult education is considered remedial, or they consider you to be just like the other 18-year-old students.
Yeah.
There just is no recognition of, you know, adults, informal learning, lifetime learning, on-the-job training. There's just no recognition of any of that in higher education.
Which is funny because it's such a large part of the European approach.
Well, and because it's a large part of the student body.
Yeah.
And it is here in the, you know, for years I've been throwing around the numbers of, you know, meetings. Inside institutions, like, well, half of us have jobs. We're adults.
Yeah.
Come on, you know. And, you know, I mentioned, I think, last week or the week before, you know, pedagogy is a perfectly perfectly good thing for developmental people. Half of us are, you know, beyond development education. We're looking for something else.
Yeah.
Whether it's andragogy or pedagogy or whatever.
Whatever, yeah.
But the system here just won't let go of, we're here to help 18-year-old develop and to be cogs in the empire's machine.
It's a very good business model for them. You know, there's the overall ethos that in you know, especially in the Western world, that people who are 18 to 22 will take 4 years and go to a residential university and pay a lot of tuition for this experience. And you know, and there are some institutions, by no means all, but some, who have over the years made billions of dollars doing this. And I know that because that's the size of their endowments.
Yeah, and those few are fine.
Yeah.
As you know, Brian Alexander is tracking the decline of the educational institutions, particularly in America, but I think he keeps an eye on it in the whole world. And their model is failing on many levels in the United States. First of all, two-thirds of us don't have a degree, and that feeds into this distrust of the educated, which we're seeing play out in politics. And, you know, so actually the model is collapsing. You know, it was good for a long time. You know, when it was specifically targeted at training immigrants to work in factories and their managers at the same time, it worked. But that's not the world we live in. So there's a, you know, the satisfaction is rising, and something's going to have to give. I would prefer that the educational institutions give and open it up to the working class and the underclass and whatever you want to call it, the vast majority of Americans, and try to help them out somehow.
Yeah. You know? As you know, that's my perspective as well. And it's interesting because, you know, when you take that sort of perspective with respect to ethics, you know, I mean, you ask, you know, what are the ethics for these institutions? You know, I mean, you're talking about a practical consideration, and I agree with that, that, you know, I mean, if they don't adopt a more open policy, they're going to collapse. But I think also there is that ethical dimension to what they're doing. Is it ethically appropriate for universities to preserve existing power structures and fail to support, you know, the legitimate aspirations of the majority of the population? I would argue that it's not, but, you know, how do you approach such an argument?
Well, I often, I was very unpopular in my institution, I have to say. I was a student leader and a shift experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some things done. But, and then when we left, they undid most of it. But anyway, as I like to point out in those meetings, I'm not just a student. I'm a lifetime taxpayer.
Yeah.
And they really do not like that being brought up in their meeting. You know, I've been paying your salaries for decades, and then I come to you to help get retrained, and you can't do it.
Yeah.
Your institution, if not yours as well. And personally, then they, you know, they're all people that have transitioned from immigrant and working class status to bourgeois status. They have a, you know, they have a good paying income. And there's some, you know, there's some psychological thing going on. I don't know, but they don't want to recognize the working class and the taxpayers and, you know, the people that, you know, they put them in those chairs, those positions. I'm in a class on intercultural communication, and we had an assignment to find a peer-reviewed paper on a different culture. So I went looking for a paper on American working class culture.
Right.
Nothing.
Which is a bit surprising, actually, because, I mean, it's certainly a large culture.
You think?
Yeah.
And kind of successful when you look at, you know, what it builds.
Yeah. It's had better days.
Absolutely.
You know, but I mean, and you know, between the two of us, we could probably sit down and list some of the attributes of that culture. You know, we could think about, for example, their attitudes toward work. It's good. you know, their attitude toward helping your neighbor, you should. You know, and even things like community service, you should be part of the fire department. If you have a volunteer fire department, which many of these communities do, you know, you should maybe belong to one of the service clubs, perhaps, or minimally, you certainly support what the service clubs are doing because they're building parks and helping people in hospitals and things like that. You know, there's a range of these things.
Honest.
Pardon?
You should be honest.
You should be humble.
Mm-hmm. Right? A man's a man.
Yeah. Right? Being humble is a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Equality.
So.
Yeah. I mean, and I cannot find that list. I've been looking for a year.
Yeah.
You know, way before this class assignment, I realized that there is nothing about the American working class being published by the academic class.
Now, I'm just shocked to take a look.
Find plenty on British, you know, their class.
Let me just check that now. Now my curiosity is a little is more piqued okay, than it was.
Live Google search.
Okay, working class ethics. All right.
Okay, so you might find one or two there. I'm specifically talking about working class culture as a culture.
Okay.
Ethics, you'll find one or two things.
Okay, let's try culture. Okay, I've got.
It was the culture part that I was shocked.
Yeah.
There's no recognition of it being separate culture.
All right, there's a Wikipedia article.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's plenty of that. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Blog posts. You know, I was talking peer-reviewed, you know, academic journal articles.
So, here we go. It's, and see also blue-collar labor history, proletarian novel. Sure, we'd be thinking of people like Faulkner, perhaps. Definitely not people like Jack Kerouac or who wrote Catcher in the Rye? I forget.
Salinger.
Yeah. Like Salinger's Holden Caulfield is a, you know, to me, he's the opposite of working class culture. He's an entitled, complaining, anyhow. But okay, so we're looking for.
So I'm a big fan of Charles Bukowski.
Okay.
I don't know if you know him. He's a Los Angeles author. Worked in a post office.
Okay.
And that, you know, is upper working class.
American working class culture. Okay.
Google Scholar. There you go.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah. Goodbye, boys. I die a true American. That's a quote from the terrific film, Gangs of New York. But that's American working class culture in the mid-1800s. That's not contemporary.
Exactly. And, yeah, and there, you know, and there were books. There were books written about working class culture, you know, but they were all from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You know, there's just nothing going on.
Yeah, this is 1979. Let's look for, say, since 2017, archaeologies. This is interesting. The pedagogy of class, teaching working class life and culture in the economy, or in the academy. Of course, it's a book, so we can't read it online. It just came out in 2020. So, which is too bad. Wonder if there's any reviews or anything. Okay, here we go. JSTOR. Again, which won't help us, but it'll give us a little bit. Okay. Yeah, stories like mine provide a picture of working class students having, quote, made it, yet still feeling like outsiders, continually immersed within the discursive and ideological conflicts they depict between working class and academic cultures. I feel that. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody that comes to wearing the black studs.
Yeah.
I stifle myself. I don't think I've ever directly addressed a professor or somebody with a PhD as a class traitor, but, the thought has crossed my mind.
Yeah. In this scenario, we read, working class and academic discourses exist in a dichotomous relationship where one discourse is depicted as in almost complete opposition to the others. Working class students succeed only if their class identity is stripped away. Sound right?
Just like to ethnic people.
Yeah.
It's the deficit model, right? Mm-hmm. Yours is a deficit culture. You need to transform yourself into the dominant culture. And it's like, no. And the working class, has a long tradition predating America of saying, no. I'm not stripping myself of my culture for you. It's not going to happen.
Now, this what I just quoted was by Donna LaCourte in her article from 2006, Performing Working Class Identity in Composition Toward a Pedagogy of Textual Practice. It's a college English, that's the journal it's in. So.
Again, it's, the performance of being working class.
Yeah.
Is not any kind of analysis of the culture of working class. That's what I was looking for. And believe me, I spent a lot of hours on it.
Oh, I believe you.
Research shows than I do, but if you come up with something, let me know, because I could.
Yeah, I'm not seeing, as you say, a whole lot here. A working class academic pedagogy. That's not really working class culture. Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I was specifically looking for as an example of intercultural communication. Yeah. So I wanted it to be about the culture and hopefully the way they communicate, but that was too much. But just something about the working class culture in the last, published in the last 60 or 70 years.
Yeah.
It's not there. So anyway, I don't want to derail here.
I like this. This one's called The Invention of Working Class Culture. It's neoliberalism and working class lives.
In British cultural studies.
Yeah. Here's something from 2020 called There Is a Genuine Working Class Culture. So, again, it's a book, so we can't read it.
Yeah, in fact, Jack Metzger is one of the founders of the Working Class Studies Association. So there's now one group in America that's just starting to publish, and that's the first book right there.
So let's find Jack Metzger. Does he have a homepage? Maybe he does. Working Class.
That's the Working Class Studies Association, maybe.
Right.
And they have a conference. I just discovered him a couple years ago. I was all signed up. I had an Airbnb, and I paid my fees. I was all ready to go to their conference in Youngstown, Ohio last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you think, this is interesting, and it's not really what I intended to talk about, but who cares?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's fine. Do you think working class culture transcends other cultural boundaries, and here I'm thinking of race and gender and religion and language. Do you think it's a common culture across these?
I think it's complicated. In fact, I know it is.
So
I see it as another intersectional standpoint.
Right.
Is the way and there's a critique that white people reach the class to avoid ethnic identity. I get that. But on the other hand, when you can't find anything about your class, and you can find, black studies departments, Latino studies departments, Asian studies departments, and there's no working class studies department, you're like, okay, I get your criticism, but I got one of my own. So, Another thing, so that led me to think, okay, let's go for ethnic identity. Mm-hmm. There are zero Scottish studies programs in the United States of America.
Right.
Yeah, really.
That seems very surprising.
And the Scots have any influence on the creation of the dominant American culture?
Oh, I'd say so.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, the Scottish Enlightenment is huge. Adam Smith, David Hume, continuing through to John Stuart. Well, John Stuart Mill is more English than Scottish, but still. Yeah, huge.
Single one. Yeah. So, there, you know, there's Celtic studies, right?
Yeah.
But I think they do more dancing than class analysis.
Yeah, and Scottish isn't strictly Celtic anyways. I mean, the modern Scottish state. I mean, you go to Scotland now, and you know, there is a very clear modern Scottish identity, which isn't just the you know, which isn't the traditional. I mean, it includes all of the traditional Scottish elements, but there's...
And there are many. And the Celts are one element.
Yeah, and there are many, and the Celts are one element. But the modern Scottish state, as I see it, is open, it's diverse, it's progressive. You know, these are, you know, and so it's a very distinct identity for sure.
In fact, I found a YouTuber named Bruce Fummy, Fummey. Who is half Ghanaian and half Scottish. And I found him because he did it. So he does a whole series of videos. He's a former teacher, and now he does travel log, a cross between travel logs and Scottish history. So he goes to places and tells the story. So I found him because one of his is called Can Black People Be Scottish?
Oh, yeah.
Because he responded to a comment he made, you know, so somebody watched one of his videos and made this comment. How ironic.
And I know for a fact that there were black people who were Scottish.
Talking about Scottish history.
Yeah.
And so he made this whole video regarding that. But he has like 4 dozen videos and an excellent grasp of Scottish history. I mean, you know, I've spent a certain amount of time, like one of my grandfathers came from Inverness, Scotland, so I've spent a bunch of time trying to learn about Scotland. Never been there, but and as far as I watched, you know, at least a dozen of Bruce Fummey's videos, and they're spot on culturally. And he gets a whole series. The Picts, the Scelts, the Celts, the Angles, the Saxons, the Normans, you know, each one an individual influence. Yeah. To me, he's doing an excellent job. And he's just a YouTuber, makes money doing this. And apparently he runs tours on the side or whatever.
What's interesting about this discussion, and there will probably be people watching this wondering, well, why is any of this relevant at all? But I think it's actually pretty much on topic even for this module, because this module is approaches to ethics. And you know, in Canada, we had a book written by a guy called John Ralston Saul, who's interestingly the husband of a former Canadian Governor General.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say husband. I think partner might be more accurate, but I'm not sure exactly. Who was it?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his lectures that became a book.
Yeah, I have to look it up because I've forgotten who the Governor General was, which is really bad because that's, you know, the Canadian head of state, and, you know, it's like forgetting a president.
And I try, but I can't forget some of the presidents.
I have like Adrian Clarkson or something like that in my head, but I'm not really sure that that's right.
Adrian Clarkson.
Is that right?
Yeah, according to Google.
Oh, okay. Very good. Oh, so I did remember it after all. I feel much better because I couldn't find it. So.
And they were married in 1999, so it wasn't.
Okay.
They were.
That might have been after. Well, I'm not sure. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter to me whether they were married or not. But I guess it does marry to other people. It does matter to other people. Anyhow. The idea of Voltaire's Bastards is essentially, you know, and I'm glossing over a lot of this, but essentially it's a critique of rationalism, and even more to the point, a critique of the idea that of the idea of using reason properly, so called, to reach for things like moral truths or how we structure society, etc. It's the dictatorship of the reasonable over everyone else, I guess. I'm putting words in his mouth here. I'm sure he never said that. Well, that's a great phrase, isn't it? The dictatorship of the reasonable. but I think that is at least a part of this distinction that can be drawn here between working class culture and academic culture, in the sense that whatever the working class person says, the academic is going to have an answer based in reason or perhaps rationalization. And
that doesn't work, they reach for authority.
And if that doesn't work, they reach for authority, yeah. Although the working class might also reach for authority of a different sort. So,
it doesn't work in settings, in my experience.
Yeah.
I'm just a worker.
Yeah. Well, you know, workers unite. The power of labor unions is very much a worker, working class kind of cultural value, although that has waned in recent years. But I would argue not really, because workers didn't want it. Again, I'd
argue there was a
complex
war wage.
Yeah. So, you know, and again,
I at college educated people. I mean, this is where you get, on the slippery part of the argument.
Yeah.
It was the college educated who waged the war. It wasn't their idea, but they run the institutions that have carried out the neoliberal agenda, which to me was a possible, in an oversimplified, but very oversimplified.
And our understanding of ethics, and especially ethics in an academic discipline, comes from this rationalist perspective to a large degree. I've got slides which I don't know if I'll present to one person here, but I'll do them later. Anyways, in a video that...
You're welcome.
Yeah, I know, but I think it's better to have a conversation here, and then I'll just present them later, and you can watch the video, because that seems a bit nicer. if there were two of you, that would be an audience, and then I'd want to present.
Yes. One is not an audience.
One is not an audience. Yeah. But, we think of ethics of whatever, and we think of, reasons and principles and arguments, maybe explanations, codes of ethics like we've just done. Ethics as something that you have to be educated in order to understand to quite a degree. There's a certain sense of that. I mean, the reason why this course exists is because there's a whole lot of people, not just working class people, but academics too, who make pronouncements on the ethics of this and that without actually understanding ethics at all. And that bothers me. And actually, it bothered me because they didn't understand ethics at all, they didn't understand AI and analytics at all, and they didn't understand learning at all. And it made for a bad combination. And you get these horribly naive statements. Now, that sounds like a classic, here's an academic talking about somebody who doesn't know anything, and I know how that sounds. Believe me, because, if somebody comes to me and says, well, you can't have an opinion on this because you're coming from a naive perspective, I know how I would respond to that, and it's not well. In fact, I have responded to it in the past, and it hasn't been well. So I get that. But even the people who present themselves as knowing all of this stuff don't. And that's when it begins to bother me, right? And that's when we see something like ethics used not as a domain of inquiry, but as a club. And that doesn't strike me as the purpose of ethics at all. And so, if you're gonna use it as a weapon, which you shouldn't, but if you're gonna, it really should be like a fine-tuned sword, not a club. that's just my prejudice speaking there, but at the very least, but it bothers me, and that's why that is why I took the approach to this course that I did. Most approaches to an ethics in anything kind of course will map out all the ethical theories first. And the idea is that you, as a student, are supposed to look at all these ethical theories and pick one, and you will be arguing from that perspective for the rest of the course. And if you think about it, that's kind of how research in education, and especially research in ed tech, is done generally, isn't it? You're given all these frameworks like instructivism, constructivism, behaviorism, cognitivism, connectivism, and they're all laid out in front of you, and you pick one, and you say, that is the lens through which I will see the world. And ethics is presented in the same way. And that doesn't feel right to me.
I would take a grounded theory and say, pick a situation, document it, and see what emerges. That to me is more.
And that's useful. More of the approach that I've taken, right? In painstakingly outlining all of the different applications and painstakingly outline all the issues that have come up that I have found. And I'm still adding applications and issues. I can't believe I missed in the list of applications content summarization. And I'm sort of going, God.
Oh, yeah.
So I've added that and therefore made obsolete.
I try to avoid those at all costs.
Well, it depends, I
see that it's a big time saver. I get it. If I was being paid to do research, I would have to, but I'm not and I don't.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a whole, this is a bit of an aside, but it's worth mentioning. There's a whole school of doing research. And I see it a lot at NRC, where the model is you do a literature search. And so you'll go into your publication repository or your publication library or your index system like Scopus or whatever, and you'll put in your keywords and you'll get a search, and that reveals 714 documents or whatever. and then you apply search terms to that or filtering criteria and bring it down to a certain amount. And then that's your basis for your literature review, which of course you will do every time you do a new study, and that's scientific method. I've lost track of why I was off on that tangent. But, oh yeah, so.
Talk about methodology.
Yeah.
Kind of theory and how you are approaching discourse.
Yeah. So these literature searches will be guided by that methodology, and they'll look for all of the, you know, all of the constructivist literature on the use of the letter A in, or whatever, you know, I'm caricaturing, obviously. And that, again, still feels wrong, and it especially feels wrong in a domain like ethics. You know, if we think about ethics, can we, you know, have we advanced our knowledge of ethics if we do a literature search in that way? I mean, doing any reading, sure, is going to advance your knowledge. But do you actually know more about ethics after such a search than you did before? And it's not clear to me that that's the case. I'm sort of, you know, I'm struggling through fog here to express the thought.
Being working class and sort of pragmatic by nature, are you then more ethical? You act more ethically after that literature and even completion of your research project.
Arguably, I was more ethical before, but. Yeah. So, I mean, now, the flip side of that is something called folk theory. And in the philosophy of mind, we see this. And I'm using the philosophy of mind here because it's a really good example. And so in the philosophy of mind, we have something called folk psychology. And folk psychology is the idea that of common, ordinary, everyday psychological states that we have. Beliefs, knowledge, truth, fears, hopes, desires, etc. And maybe a bit of a story about how they have a causal impact. For example, if you want something, you will go get that something, or if, you know, if you have a desire for something, you're more likely to work for it. You know, there's a whole range of common aphorisms that come for that, come out of that, and you can construct a fully blown psychological theory based on folk psychology, and people have done that. And in fact, it's, you know, it's probably the dominant theory in philosophy of mind. But what if it's wrong? And there's another perspective, which I actually think is closer to being correct, to the effect that there aren't really any such things as beliefs or desires or hopes. Maybe we could say there are emotions, but we'd really have to revisit how we describe that, and so on and so forth, right? And folk psychology is just based on a misinterpretation of our own mental states. I mean, we think we understand our own mental states, but really we're in the worst position in the world to be observing them, which is probably true, you know. There are new views now of psychology. One of them, for example, is called eliminativism, which is a $10 word, which means we eliminate these folk psychological categories and see what's left. And that's where you get a lot of these philosophies of psychology based on neuroscience and things like that. And so a word like belief is just a catchphrase we use to refer to a wide variety of neural states that don't really have anything in common and certainly can't be thought of as a cause of anything as a class, but it's a handy way of talking. And is it Dennett talks about taking the intentional stance where we'll keep talking that way, but really what we're talking about is these neural states. Dennett, I think it's Dennett. I know it's not Dummett. It's not Davidson. Must be Dennett.
Dennett is the philosopher that's very scientifically oriented. I know that.
Yeah.
Neurologically oriented.
I'm old, my brain is going, I lose names. I'm just kidding.
CRS, do you use that term?
Pardon?
CRS, I often say I have CRS, I can't remember stuff.
Yeah, I can't remember stuff, yeah, that's, yeah. For me, my bugbear has always been names. Just names are so arbitrary. And one of the things my brain does not do is take this arbitrary thing and join it with that arbitrary thing. And naming proper names are just that. And I know there's secrets as to, you know, how you can create these associations, but I've never spent the time doing that, so.
Never had a job in sales.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
So if we come back to ethics, same thing might be true.
So before we circle back, hold that, you know, that button.
Yep.
So I had the, coincidence, I guess is right, they said, of bumping into Timothy Leary in the 70s and actually looking a little further than his pop image.
Yep.
And if you ever run across his work that got him to Harvard, their interpersonal theory of personality.
Oh, interesting. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's written in the 50s, based on work at the Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California, the psychiatric ward. And his theory is we don't have personalities. I think you'll like this. That we don't have, quote, personalities, unquote.
Right.
That we operate in relation to other people. So it's kind of a connectivist theory of personality. And then at the same time, Alan Watts is still alive and had a local radio program, and so I got into Buddhism. And so there's lifelong history there.
Yeah.
And the more you study Buddhism, the more you look into it, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
It's all made up. You know, the harder you look,
yeah,
the more you find nothing. It's all just a story, as my favorite thing college professor says.
That's also a core tenet of Taoism as well. The categories that we impose on the world are, in fact, categories that we've imposed on the world.
Exactly. So it gets you right back to the root language, the use of language, all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons I began to practice. Because I could spend most of my days being productive.
Yeah.
And there was no lying or misunderstanding going on. There was, does this thing work at the end of the day? Oh, it works? Let's sell it. See you tomorrow.
It's kind of like why I like computers. and it's an interesting thing, right? I mean, with computers, it either works or it doesn't. Well, that's not strictly true because it could work but produce random results, which is, that's probably,
but you're moving towards the working model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's even a school of thought that depicts ethics as a technical problem. I don't think I'd go that far. But yeah, I mean, and I certainly agree with this perspective that, you know, a lot of this, most of this, probably all of this is artificial. These are things that we've created and impose on a state of you know, it will impose on the world.
I wouldn't use the word term artificial. I mean, they're human creatures.
Yeah.
Just like the chair you're sitting in. I wouldn't call it artificial. It's a chair. It is what it is. It does what it does.
Yeah. But, and that's a good point. Constructivism is essentially the idea that we deliberately construct these things, right? Making meaning. But I don't think that that's the case at all. Because as you say, it's just a chair. I mean, this is something we're going to do, call it a chair, whether or not we're a constructivist. Doesn't mean that the world is naturally, or really, if we want to put it that way, divided into things that are chairs and things that are not chairs. You know, we haven't said anything profound about the state of the world by saying this is a chair. In fact, we haven't really said anything about anything at all, except maybe ourselves. But if we as a self don't exist...
Well, we have no personality. We are a piece of protoplasm that, you know, wanders around. You know, and that gets, I mean, that points to the discussion, you know, is language an innate feature of this particular mammal species?
No.
Or not?
Yeah.
You know, and there's no answer, but the whole idea of the language, you know, being constructed, being culturally constructed, all that. That's all fine, but maybe it's just that we like to make noises.
Well, and that's it. We make noises. And that's, you know, and I want to be careful here, right? Because I don't want to say, well, yeah, we're humans, so naturally we make noises. Because now that's an appeal to some kind of real state of affairs describing what is natural and what isn't. And that's no better either, right? We're just back where we started. Saying
but we have been selecting for a few hundred thousand years.
Well, that's the scientific explanation of what has happened, and it's the best explanation we have to this point. And, you know, pretty much all of science depends on that particular principle, certainly all of biological science. So if we reject that, we reject all of biological science, which isn't practical. and we're not likely to do it. And even if we had evidence, and this is an important realization, just in the last 30 or 40 years, maybe 50 years, of the philosophy of science, even if we had evidence to show us that evolution is false, we still wouldn't abandon it. We would question the evidence. Because far more of what we do and what we know depends on evolution than could ever depend on that particular evidence. And so, you know, there's this idea that there's this critical experiment that proves evolution is true or proves that it's false just isn't the case. There's this entire assemblage of theory and practical implementation and diagnosis and vaccine research and the whole works, right? Through in vaccine, just to be topical. But you know what I mean, right? There's this, now it doesn't mean you have to accept it all or accept none of it. There's plenty of room around the edges for disagreements, but evolution's one of these things where if you disagree with evolution, you're pretty much committed to disagreeing with the entire lot. And that's what makes it hard. I wonder, now, people sort of assume there are central principles like that in ethics, too. What would be the theory of evolution, for example, in ethics? Or what would be the law of gravity in ethics? But, yeah, I see you shaking your head, and I'm inclined to agree. That's a lot harder to come by. Because if we look... Well, as we have at the different principles and the different issues that come up, just doesn't seem to be a center to all of this. There's one discussion. What was his name or their names? lost it. It's here somewhere. Here we go. Moss and Metcalf saying that ethics maybe is too big a word for what we're after. Because, well, in the sense that the word ethics seems to include corporate values, moral justice, compliance with ethical codes, all of these range of things. I'm not sure I agree with that either. I think I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea of ethics.
Well, I was surprised that you limited it to institutional ethical codes. I hadn't thought of it that way before. And I see the practicality of that. But I came in with that larger idea of ethics. You know, beliefs, mores, ethical code, you know, as a larger set.
Yeah.
But doing it this way, I see that that's unworkable.
I did it all religions
and then, you know, and then your folkways and, you know, that's an impossible task. So.
Yeah, I looked at the ethical codes too, because again, they're part of this whole ethics as a club thing. And it's interesting because we have ethics as a club in the sense of weapon and ethics as a club as in the sense of the people who are together, who are in the know. But if you look, I'm putting a link in today's course newsletter referencing a UNESCO report on the ethics of artificial intelligence in education.
That end of the sheet, if I remember correctly.
Sorry?
I think I dropped that into the sheet. I added that. You may well have. I think that was one of the ones.
I wouldn't be surprised because the reason why it's in there is because it was sitting on my desktop and I couldn't let go of it. I kept going back to it and looking at it a little more and going back to it and looking at it a little more. And then I thought, I can't let go of this, so I guess I got to deal with it. But the way I was thinking of it is, well, now that we've done this scope of applications and ethical issues and ethical codes, now we're in a position to properly appreciate that particular document. And if you look at the references and the examples, they are virtually all of the sorts of things that we've been talking about so far, and especially the ethical codes aspect of it. That is the standard of evidence that they're using. But I agree that that's too small a standard. It's too narrow a scope. But back before I did that inquiry, I would talk about ethics. And I'm thinking back in particular to remarks made by Jenny McNess back at the time. Who basically said, while I'm talking about ethics, really I should be looking at these ethical codes, the ethics of the profession, that my discussion wasn't addressing the current reality of ethics. And, that kind of bothered me. Because I had posted, and I'll provide the link again in this week's newsletter. I'd posted basically an overall guide to ethics as it applies to education, and that's when the criticism came out. I said to her back then, this is years ago, well, yeah, I guess I'll have to address all of that in a part two. She said, well, I'm looking forward to part two then. So this is part two. this whole big mess.
How are you spelling your last name?
Macknesss.
Ah. There's my Scottish bias. I always
no K. Yeah. And it's all lowercase letters.
Rhizomatic learning in ethics.
Yeah. She's very good. And she was a participant in some of the earlier courses on connectivism and such. And recently she's been more interested in the bicameral mind guy.
Yeah, that was big in the '80s, but I just let that one go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't stop work with the stuff that he did in the '80s, so.
Yeah, no, he had a tenured position, so if he's still alive, yeah. He's still got that position.
Yeah, so, okay, no, not Julian James, who's the one who came up with it, but someone else, it's a mix something.
Another one.
Yeah, another one. And I can't find it.
Origin of Consciousness, Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, 76, Princeton psychologist Julian James.
Yeah. But that's not the person who she's studying. It's something like McGillivray or something. Ian Gilchrist? I think McGilchrist. There we go. That's who she's been studying. And I haven't been following that particular... Well, I've been following it, but not nearly as closely as I would need to in order to be able to comment reasonably on what she's been learning about that, so I won't. But that's where her study has gone since then. But I still follow what she's doing.
One of the top searches here is a wiki, Wikiwan. But it calls it bicameral mentality, which takes it beyond the biology.
Yeah.
In the psychology, it looks like.
So.
I'll look at that.
But again, you know.
In his emissary, reminds me of the alphabet versus the goddess, another bicameral mind theory. You remember that? That was from the 70s, I think.
No, but I can probably construct it from that title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was it was an interesting theory, but then he kind of lost his way, so he discredited himself.
A lot of this stuff goes back to some of the early psychological experiments that involved severing the corpus callosum, which is the bundle of nerves that join the two hemispheres of the brain, and those resulted in almost like split personalities in the sense that it was like we now had two different people in there. And so you think, well, if we had two different people, and then we get, all the characterizations of the different character of these two different people and drawing on the right side of the brain and all of that. I'm not really a fan of, right brain, left brain theory. And the reason for that is that it just describes way too much to innateness and to, the actual construction of the human brain than I think is appropriate. I don't think you can make brains either left or right hemisphere that focus on art or focus on reasoning, even if that's how they happen to come out.
It's not a biology or neurology, it's a mentality. I get that. And the recent research on plasticity and, now we have all these veterans. In the United States, we have all these veterans with brain injuries studying. And so they're watching the brain recover functions by just moving from the damaged area. So the plasticity argument, works against that.
Yeah.
But yet, there is a certain bicameral mentality. And then handedness comes in. And I deliberately became ambidextrous. I grew up right-handed because of my trade and an accident to my right hand. I was already interested in handedness and worked on dexterity in my left hand.
Yeah.
Then I had an accident and cut some tendons and a nerve in my right hand. And so for a couple of years, I worked left-handed, basically.
Yeah.
And after that, the work got a lot easier, and you can do multiple things if both of your hands know what they're doing. And then you think about that, it's like, so, you know, and then there's supposedly the cross, you know, use of the nervous system, and, you know, what's my brain doing if my hand's doing two different things at the same time? And then, you know, that's just juggling. So, I mean, it's all connected, it's all interesting, and again, we don't understand it.
And I think all of that applies to ethics, all of it. And that, I think, is the distinction between the approach that I'm taking here and the approach that you find in the UN document and the codes of ethics approach, and for that matter, even the approach that ethics is something that, you know, we go through, you know, formal or semi-formal reasoning about, that ethics is something that we discover as though it were mathematics, or invent as though it were a categorization system for the world. I'm looking for, and I think have a sense of something that is more basic than that, something that is like learning to become left-handed, or something that is like you know, the plasticity of mind, as, you know, the basis for our story of ethics, whatever that's going to be.
So since we're doing this informally, I assume that you're not going to post this as today's thing with the slideshow, or not, whatever you're going to do. Anyway.
I'm going to post this discussion, unless you have some objection to it, but I don't see
why. Not at all. It's just, so I have this overriding question that I didn't want to start off your presentations with, but here's the perfect opportunity, because also, you know, we've been here almost an hour and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So why people with the most elaborate codes of ethics, why is it those professions do the most unethical things? The Catholic Church, American lawyers, and I include higher education.
Yeah.
Why is it the ones with the most elaborate codes of ethics are the people that are, you know, in my view, destroying the culture?
Yeah. I think there's two answers to that. One part of the answer is found in Voltaire's Bastards, and the other part of the answer is found in the short, simple expression, they can. I know that sounds terrible, but, you know, I think it's
the power of the class, you know, those classes that have those codes also have the power.
Yeah.
And that goes back to last week. It's, people will act unethically no matter what you do.
Yeah.
So it's the confluence of power and obedience.
Yeah.
And I'm a sociologist, so it's power and obedience together.
Yeah. But this looks forward a bit to where we're going to go at the end of the course. It was probably a good way of finishing off for today. We see all of this. And, you know, we see the activities that you've just described, the things that lawyers do, that the church does, etc. And we say that it's unethical. Who are we to say this?
Well, by their own standards. That's the thing. By their own code
of ethics. Yeah. Yeah, okay. But sure, they may be hypocrites, or they may be saying one thing and doing another. Which I guess is sort of the same thing. But, you know, we have to also take into account the fact that we just might not understand what ethics really are. And that although we might go along, or, you know, maybe even be convinced by this charade that says, for example, killing is wrong, if we really understood ethics, maybe we'd see that, no, in fact, killing is right. And it's we who are mistaken. Or let's take even a worse approach. well, maybe worse is the wrong word, a more
disturbing
a more empirical approach, right?
Oh, okay.
What if ethics actually is what we all believe and what we all do ethically? What if, you know, meaning is use, as Wittgenstein would say? Then it turns out that the actual ethics that humanity as a whole believes in allows that killing is good. And why do we say that? Well, look what we do.
Look at the evidence.
Look at the evidence. Right? So if you got a problem with that, maybe the problem is with your understanding of ethics. Now, not really something I want to support particularly, but I think that's something that we need to take seriously. And, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we talk about, you know, taking a gap-based approach, right? What if, cynically, ethics just is a tool that, say, the powerful use to control the less powerful? You know, it's not actually in the outline or in any of my work at all, but there's the whole philosophy of Nietzsche fits in nicely here. You know, with his, you know, what would Superman's ethics be? Or there's the philosophy of the transvaluation of value. What if we took all of our values and flipped them upside down? So right is wrong, good is bad, etc. Or what we consider bad is actually good. What would our objections to that be? And we find that there really aren't any, none that don't sound like rationalizations. So that, I think, is something that we need to take seriously as well. So, and that's pretty much the focus of the second part of the course. But in there is this considerable speed bump, which is the duty of care. And that's what makes things really interesting to me anyway.
Yes, because then you have a different set of evidence.
You have a different set of evidence.
That, you know, explains the story differently.
Yeah.
If it's just power, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually kind of believe that. I kind of believe that the world is upside down. That we say one thing and do that. You know, growing up in America, it's pretty easy to have that point of view.
Yeah.
But then you really problematize it. There's one of my big words I learned in college. To problematize that approach by adding the duty of care or the cautionary principle or malfeasance. It's mal-efficacy.
Okay.
It's
mal something.
It's principle in one word, mal something. Anyway, when you add that, then you can analyze the actions, you know, the reality, and then try to tease that out from the ethical codes.
Okay, I think that's a good note to finish on. I'm going to do this presentation this afternoon. It'll show up in the newsletter as well as a presentation from last week. That'll finish off last week. Plus the link. And I've got some fun toys planned for this week as well. I just have to code them. But
yeah, and I need to catch up a bit anyway.
Yeah.
I haven't done my links yet. I have done some tweets and, you know, put some stuff in the document.
Yeah.
I need to do my links.
But
plus,
yeah.
I have homework at the class due tonight. So.
Yep.
Anyway.
Busy.
All right.
All right.
See you later.
Talk to you later.